What if you had an airtight argument and a locked down system of understanding God, the world, and your role in it? What if you had a rule book that told you exactly how to live? I mean, wouldn't it be so relieving to have an exhaustive book that functioned as a complete authority on science, the divine, on how to live, on what to eat, on relationships, on what to do with lawbreakers, and perhaps most importantly, on how to differentiate between those who are in your club versus those who are out of your club? It would be a policy manual that had an answer for every question, a law textbook that detailed the exception to every rule. And best of all, it would provide utter relief to the gnawing questions of life because everything would be spelled out. Life would be so simple, so straightforward, so clean and tidy. Wouldn't you love to live in a black and white universe like this? Well, this is pretty much how the Jews were living 2,000 years ago. But then, some guy named Jesus comes on the scene and completely dismisses and dismantles this one-dimensional stereotype of how to understand the world, God, and ourselves. And perhaps most infuriatingly, this Jesus seems to enjoy breaking the boundaries. He is almost, dare I say, nonchalant in how he deconstructs a rule system that simply won't work for humans who are made in the image of God. Jesus completely breaks the rules of who God is supposed to be and what he is supposed to do and when he is supposed to do it. In fact, Jesus has kind of made a habit of being a renegade in the Gospel of John. And so when we pick up the story today, you'll see that his very own disciples, the townspeople, the law-keeping Pharisees, and the Jews as a whole are trying to trick him, to make him guilty of breaking their rules so they can prove he's not God. It seems everyone in this story would rather stay with the predictable prison of rule keeping than surrender to the possibility of a completely free, dynamic, and all-powerful God. Let's start with his own disciples. In verses 1 and 2, Jesus' disciples ask a great question about suffering. Rabbi, or teacher, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? This is a question with a big assumption behind it. The assumption that all suffering is viewed as punishment. It's a pretty condemning way to live life, thinking that God intentionally makes someone suffer because they or even their parents sinned. But that's the rule book his disciples are using to understand and live life. And so they conclude that somebody did something wrong at some point in order for this beggar to be born blind. Jesus answers the question in an astounding way that takes some heavy lifting for our translation efforts. Naturally, any English translation can only get close to the original Greek, and Jesus' response is particularly challenging for English, which can lead to even greater confusion about this story. Let's walk through it. In verses 3 and 4, here's how the NIV and almost every other English translation reads. Neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus, but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. As long as it is day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. The translation starts out okay, in that Jesus says that neither the man nor his parents are the reason for the man's blindness. The catch here is that the NIV tells us that Jesus states the man was made blind by God in order for God to heal him. The implication is that God allowed the man to be born blind so that many years later God's power could be shown in the restoration of his sight. That's a pretty big statement about the sovereignty of God and how he orders life. But is that what the text is really saying? Well, first, the words, "this happened," have been added by the NIV translators, and there are no such corresponding words or thoughts in the Greek text. Second, early Greek manuscripts of the New Testament were not punctuated. That is, there were no commas, periods, quotation marks, etc. So if we simply look at verses 3 through 4 without punctuation and try to read them without intonation that can also lead our understanding, it would look and sound something like this. Jesus replied that neither this man sinned nor his parents, but so that the works of God may be revealed in him, it is necessary for us to work the works of him who sent me. While it is day, night is coming when no one is able to work. Reading this sounds like me as a 9-year-old girl trying to read the Bert Stein Bears to my little brother and not being quick enough to pick up the quotation marks, which resulted in baby brother sounding like Mama Bear at the worst possible moments. Clearly, punctuation is helpful and necessary in English. But given that the earliest Greek texts didn't have it, we have to be really careful to not read into the text with where we put all those little but important dots and dashes. Of course, translation decisions still have to be made, and English simply doesn't function without punctuation. So the question is there a better way to translate these verses? Scholars agree that a better punctuation of the text would read like this. Jesus replied, "Neither this man sinned nor his parents. But so that the works of God may be revealed in him, it is necessary for us to work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one is able to work." Punctuated this way, the text implies not that the man was born blind so that the works of God may be revealed in him, but that Jesus had to carry out the work of God while it was day, in essence, during Jesus' earthly ministry, so that God's work might be revealed in the life of the man born blind. That's a huge difference when it comes to asking the big why questions of life and when we try to understand what God is like. I think this nuance has some important ramifications for us with how we view suffering today. For example, we need to be really careful to not say things that really have no biblical substance, such as, God allowed your child to get cancer so that God could show his mighty power through her. Such statements make God an incredibly cruel author of life, twisting our perception of him and truly offering no substantial answers for when that child doesn't get better, or why she got sick in the first place. So we need to make sure that we're thinking biblically about how we speak about the nature of God, the nature of suffering, and how those play out in our experience of life. Before we move into the actual healing of the blind man, let's look at one more interesting nuance of how Jesus speaks. In verse 4, he says, "As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me." Jesus pulls his disciples into the mission of God by intentionally using the royal we. His disciples were being kind of aggressive with asking a leading question. And not only does Jesus turn the question on its head, but he also graciously invites his disciples to participate with him in the work of restoration. We must do the works of him who sent me. Not only is Jesus a renegade, but he also invites those who taunt him to join him in the work of renewal. Jesus invites us to lay aside our preconceived notions of the divine and to participate with him in his work of healing. In verses 6 through 7, Jesus does the actual miracle. And again, he's kind of coy. In fact, in Ellie's words to me earlier this week, sorry, Ellie, Jesus could almost be seen as being passive-aggressive here. Jesus spits on the ground and makes mud with saliva and then rubs it on the man's eyes. Is it just me or is this pretty weird for our 21st century minds? There's a backstory to what Jesus is doing, and it's this. The Pharisees had added 39 specific points and further subpoints to the commandment to not work on the Sabbath. They said there are 39 specific implications of what may or may not be considered work. One of those addendums was making mud to be used in any form of manual labor, like bricklaying. And believe it or not, the additional subpoint was that you couldn't even rub saliva with dirt to fix a crack in a jar. So, not only does Jesus heal on the Sabbath, he intentionally breaks one of those 39 additional laws to make it crystal clear that he is breaking the Pharisees' definition of Sabbath keeping. He then tells the blind man to go wash in the pool of Siloam. Now, if you remember from an earlier sermon in this series, we talked about the Feast of Tabernacles, where Israel remembers God's provision of water in the wilderness, and they celebrated it with pouring ceremonial water over the altars in the temple. Well, the Jews would gather the water for this ceremony from the pool of Siloam. Jesus is pretty smart miracle worker here. He is again saying that all of life and healing and vitality is found in him. He makes all things new. All of life is found in him. The result from the mud and the washing is that the man sees for the very first time in his life. The initial response by the man's neighbors is confusion. Is this the man who was the blind beggar? A ruckus starts over the confusion, and the neighbors bring the man to the Pharisees. What follows is the astounding reality that the Pharisees don't care about the benefits of the miracle, that the man received his sight and would no longer be subjected to a life of begging, but that they only concern themselves with how Jesus performed the miracle so that they can use it against him. If they can prove that Jesus broke the Sabbath, it would make him a violator of God's law, and therefore it would be impossible for Jesus to be God. In verse 24, the Pharisees go so far as to demand that the man give glory to God by admitting that Jesus was a sinner and was acting in the wrong. In the face of insults heaped upon him, the man's boldness only increased. In verse 25, he says, "One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see." This simple, blind beggar has more knowledge of God than the men who made a career out of studying the nature and character of God. By the time we get to verse 35, we find that since receiving his sight, the man born blind has been taken to the Pharisees by his neighbors, left to answer for himself by his parents, interrogated, insulted, and thrown out by the Jews as someone whom they accuse of being born in utter sin, unworthy of healing, and unqualified to teach them. Through it all, this man's appreciation of Jesus grows. At first, he referred to him as the man called Jesus. Then he said he was a prophet. And most recently, he argued that he must be a godly person who did God's will. After being thrown out by the Pharisees, Jesus once again comes and finds this man. Jesus again and again pursues the man born blind, and by the time we get to verse 38, the blind man has made his final steps to faith in Jesus, where he says, "Lord, I believe," and worships Jesus. He identifies Jesus as the glorious Son of God and worships him. This, friends, is the ultimate step of allegiance, for to worship someone is to give your love, affection, attention, desire, and very self to. To worship is not to just follow a set of rules in the interest of self-preservation. No, to worship is to utterly abandon yourself to someone. This renegade Jesus, whom the blind man worships, turns our understanding of God, of suffering, of right and wrong on its head. Look at Jesus' response to the man worshiping him. In verse 39, Jesus says, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." In the Gospels, Jesus kisses little babies and says they are like God. He elevates women. He makes friends with drunkards, adulterers, prostitutes, and tax collectors. In the Gospels, Jesus turns our understanding of law and order upside down and says that the way to the kingdom is not through rule keeping, but turning all our affection, our devotion, our love, our passion toward Him. Well, what is the result? When this renegade Jesus comes into our world, the blind see, and those who thought they had crystal clear sight with their laws and rules become blind. Later in the New Testament, Paul describes what Jesus and the gospel are all about in making the analogy that Christ is like an aroma. In 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, Paul says that Christ is an aroma to those who are being saved, and that the result is that we, in turn, become an aroma to others. Paul says, "To the one, we are the smell of death. To the other, the fragrance of life." Friends, when we worship Christ, when all our affection, devotion, love, and adoration is poured into Christ, the result is that we become His fragrance to the world. We, in turn, become little Christs who may be viewed as utter renegades or as those who carry the sweet fragrance of the aroma of the living God. As we do so, we join Christ in His work of adoration and restoration. May the grace of Christ be free to abide and live in us so that we may see and savor Christ and allow His aroma to capture the imagination and attention and worship of those around us to the glory and praise of Christ.